Thank you for your kind words, dear Father, Reverend Fathers, dear friends in Christ. Not so long ago, Cardinal Ratzinger declared that one of the greatest dangers threatening the Catholic Church today is an evil called feminism. Now, just to show you the extraordinary spiritual vitality of the Catholic Church, she always offers us answers in the very moment that dramatic questions are being raised. What is the role of women in the Church? And a few years ago, when our great Pope beatified Edith Stein, he proposed her as a model of femininity. So my talk is dedicated to her life and her accomplishments. And one of the things that we're going to discover is that Edith Stein, who was a feminist, had every reason to be tempted by feminism, through the grace of God, became one of the great apostles of true femininity. She was the last child of a family of 11. Four of them died at young age. She was born in Breslau on the Day of Atonement, on the 12th of October, 1891. Her father died when she was very young, and her remarkable mother, Augusta, took over the lumber business that her father had started. And through dint of efforts, courage, generosity, self-devotion to her family, she managed to make of it a successful business. Augusta Stein was a child of a family of 16. Only one of them died when they were young, and she was trained from the moment she was 4 to work and to work hard. There was nothing that she wasn't trained to do, and she considered that work was a blessing because she saw it as a service to God. She came from a very Orthodox Jewish family, and down to her death, she practiced Judaism in the sense that she would, days of penance and atonement. She wouldn't eat from morning to night. She would faithfully go to the synagogue. And she trained all her children to respect the moral law. The most serious thing and severe things that she could say to a child was, "Don't do this. It is a sin." She had a special love for her last born. And we're going to see that this special love was in some way going to lead to a tragedy. Little Edith, from the time she was a tiny child, turned out to be extraordinarily talented. Her brothers and sisters were going to school and then come home and do their homework or memorize poetry. And already at the age of 4, she caught up with them so well that you wouldn't be surprised to hear that she was capable of reciting poetry of Schiller and Goethe when she was a small little child. She started going to school, and as expected, she was the very best in everything that she accomplished. It was a matter of course that Edith Stein was the brightest, the most talented, the most outstanding students of the school. She was very good at detecting other people's weaknesses. And we're going to see that it's only a loving charity that she learned later on that he will change this trait into a very loving attitude towards others. By the time she was 14, she had become a rationalist, absolutely convinced that human reason was the key to truth and to knowledge. And she totally lost her faith. She would still accompany her mother to the synagogue as a sign of piety because it made her mother feel happy, but she had no faith whatever. In some way you can say she had become a rationalist and an atheist. At 15 or 16, she decided to study Latin. For some reason, she wanted to go to the university, and it was required that she conquers this beautiful tongue. And she never knew at this time that it was going to have an enormous influence on her life and in some way become crucial in her spiritual life. Her femininity was not very apparent when she was a little girl. She was always bent over books. She was always reading books. She was always memorizing. She was always studying. She had a sort of absolutely boundless hunger for knowledge. And nevertheless, there was a particular situation in which one discovered that she actually had lovely feminine traits. Her older brother was married and was living in the large house that they now inhabited. And one of the children became very sick. And the child's mother discovered that she had no talent to take care of sick children. She was no good at it. And Edith took over and managed to calm the child, to cuddle the child, to give the child whatever it pleased. And in some way, you can discover, she discovered this maternal instinct in her that had been totally covered up because, as I said, she was just spending her day reading books. She entered the University of Breslau and took an enormous amount of courses: philosophy, psychology, history, all German, contemporary German, any branch that she could, and she had a fantastic, enormous program. And once again, you will not be surprised to hear that she was the best in everything that she did. You know, an A+ was, let us say, the very least that she could expect from her work, and she got it. One day, one of her professors said to her, "Are you enjoying your studies?" She said, "Yes, I love them." And he said, "Well, that's a pleasure to hear, because very few students feel the way that you do." And yet, at the very same time, she almost died asphyxiated. She was sharing a room with her sister. There was a gas lamp that wasn't functioning properly. And had her older sister not opened the door and discovered that the gas was all over the place, she would have died. And when her sister shook her out, she was in a sort of slumber, she said, "Oh, why did you wake me?" Now, therefore, you have this strange situation of someone who loves her studies, succeeds in whatever she's doing, and nevertheless seems to be totally indifferent at the thought that she could have died. Now, this is very interesting because it shows that deep down there was an unsatisfied longing for something great. Edith was always convinced that she was called to something very great and very special. One day, she happened to read the book of a man who was depicting very vividly the type of lives that students lead at universities. Do I need to tell you that it's not very much better than when you go to soldiers' barracks? She was so horrified, she was so shocked, she was so depressed by discovering the way that many people did live, that she decided, she fell into a deep, deep depression, and she could not get out of it until, she tells us, there was a series of concerts in Breslau on Bach. And one very fine day, she heard this famous cantata of Bach, "Oh, God is a fortress." And this is how she came out of this depression. She had a very keen moral sense. And of course, she had to thank her mother for it, because her mother was an extraordinarily moral woman. And after 4 semesters at the University of Breslau, she decided that this university had nothing more to offer her. She knew it all. And she was looking for another place where she could continue her studies. One professor mentioned that there was a very famous book written by a man called Edmund Husserl, who had founded a philosophical school called phenomenology, and that this man was gaining currency in Germany. And she took hold of this book, 2 big fat volumes, which she devoured from beginning to end. And she was so impressed that she decided to go to Göttingen, a small university. You know, it was not only a town that had a university, but it was a university town because the whole of Göttingen was basically university professors and their families. And her cousin happened to be teaching mathematics in Göttingen. He said, you know, Göttingen is an amazing place. There you're going to find out that that students talk philosophy in cafes, when they go to a dance, when they go to a party, on the street, on excursions, in the classroom. In other words, there is philosophy going on from morning to night. And this convinced her that Göttingen was a place that she had to go to. And so this young woman, age 21, brilliant, successful, was considered to be a genius by anyone who approached her, suddenly moved to Göttingen. She did not know at that time that there was something called providence, but this move was going to be providential. Now, let us try to understand or to imagine who was Edith Stein at the age of 21, abandoning Breslau, which she had been so successful, and moving to Göttingen. She is outstandingly gifted. She had received a sort of intelligence which is so extraordinary that very few people get it. On top of it, a fantastic memory and a great ambition. I know people that are very intelligent, but they have little memory and no ambition, and they don't succeed. Or they have a tremendous memory, but are not very intelligent, and that doesn't do you much good. Edith Stein combined the three things. She was outstandingly intelligent, she had a fantastic memory, and simultaneously she wanted to succeed. She was extraordinarily ambitious, and she wanted to achieve something outstanding. She was very self-assured, absolutely convinced that she could succeed in whatever she decided to do. And she was convinced that all you needed to do in order to succeed was to will. We're going to see what Göttingen is going to teach her. She was a feminist, and she relates in her autobiography that one day she had a talk with her sister, one of her sisters, and two friends. Suppose that you are married and you have a career. What should have priority? And the two friends and her sister said, well, somehow we feel that husband and child is more important than a career. And Edith declared that she was totally in disagreement. She said, for me, my career is number one. Life is strange. Later on, her sister and these two friends got married and kept their career. And Edith Stein gave up everything because she found the precious pearl. Now, therefore, this is the sort of person that she won when she entered the University of Göttingen. She's no doubt a very moral person, a sense of honesty, truthfulness, conscientiousness. She hated impurity, and she relates in her memoirs that when she was 20, had she read the Catholic teaching about marriage, she would have endorsed it completely and totally. But simultaneously, and this is something that I would like to emphasize, all these natural virtues have their reverse side. When these virtues are not transfigured and transformed by Christ, they are, I'm quoting St. Augustine, splendid vices. St. Augustine speaks about the virtues of pagans and said, among pagans I have found admirable virtues, but they lack humility. And the very moment that you have natural virtues lacking humility, I'm sorry to say that these virtues can be distorted into vices. Obviously, if you're extraordinarily honest, remarkably truthful, or very, very pure in your life, and you condemn people who don't live up to these standards, you don't realize that you might become a Pharisee. Edith knew nothing at this point of humility. As I said, she has an enormous ambition. If you look at pictures of Edith when she went to Göttingen, she was a girl with a very severe-looking expression, sort of unapproachable, something very noble, but somehow extremely severe and stern, a certain sweetness that was hidden in her heart had not yet developed. She's extremely critical. And one very fine day, a friend of hers at the University of Breslau said, "You know, I hope that when you go to Göttingen, you're going to meet professors that will satisfy you because you've become so incredibly critical." Now that meets that, so to speak, wounds her to the quick, because as she relates herself in the autobiography, "I was not used to criticism. From the time she was born, she had received nothing but compliments. And all of a sudden, there's someone saying to her, 'Do you realize that you've become extremely critical,' implying very unkind. Don't forget that she left Breslau because she was convinced that the university had nothing more to teach her. She had taken a course on psychology, several courses on experimental psychology, and she speaks about them and saying psychology is a science in diapers." You know, which is a very good way of saying it's not yet to be taken seriously. You know, these are opinions, but it's not real knowledge. Another friend of hers at Breslau, before she left for Göttingen, said to her, "Edith, do you realize that you are delightfully wicked?" Meaning to say that she was criticizing other people very wittily, but somehow there was very little charity. Once again, she is wounded and just, she has food for thought, something that she never thought about before. She acknowledges that when she was at the University of Breslau, she never, never invited her friends to come to her house from fear that they would notice that her mother had rough hands and that she had been doing blue-collar work her whole life long. She was ashamed of this remarkable woman. Once again, you see the amount of pride, intellectual pride, that was in Edith. She was nevertheless the mother's pet child, and in spite of her extreme reserve, very difficult to approach, she was popular because when you did talk to her, she was kind and friendly. She had a very keen sense for her Jewishness and a deep attachment to her people. And like most German Jewish people, an enormous attachment to Germany and even to Prussia, something that my husband never shared. He had very little sympathy for Prussia, but she had a great attachment to Prussia and considered the Prussian mentality to have remarkable qualities. She was basically a liberal in politics, even though at the University of Breslau, this liberalism was somewhat tempered and she became a bit more conservative. She was conscious of the fact that she was superior to anybody that she had met. And as I said, in April 1913, she enters the University of Göttingen. God was waiting for her in the background. Why? For the first time in her life, Edith Stein made the acquaintance of people whose intelligence matched hers or was possibly superior to hers. She had these two remarkable teachers at the University of Göttingen, was Edmund Husserl, who was no doubt a genius, even though genius can make and do make very serious mistakes. And the other one was Adolf Reinach, who totally formed my own husband, who was a man of remarkable intelligence, great integrity and nobility of character, and who in some way became Edith Stein's ideal. For the first time, she made the acquaintance of a philosophical school called phenomenology. Now, the word phenomenology is not particularly fortunate and misleading, but basically One of the principles that phenomenology is based on is to learn to be receptive to the message of being, to let the object talk, not to allow that my prejudices, my preformed ideas, my subjective wishes color the object and prevent it from revealing itself. I mean, just imagine the importance of this attitude in relationship to other people. You know, very often we approach other people with prejudices, or he comes from this background, or he says this particular race, or this particular thing, and we don't let people, we don't give them a chance of revealing themselves. Now, in order for me to get to know you, I have to be receptive and I have to listen. And this is what we don't do. We talk and we don't listen. Now, in phenomenology, they were trained to say, give being a chance. Give being a listening ear. Be reverent towards being. Now, this was for Edith something of extreme importance because her mind had been so quick and so talented that she always thought she had the answers. And suddenly she realized there's a great deal more to do, namely to listen. Reverence. Reverence towards being. She was an atheist, but a couple of times she took a crash course with Max Scheler, who was a fallen away Catholic, but somehow his teaching was deeply impregnated by Catholicism. And he was a man who spoke about faith and the greatness of faith and the greatness of the church. And all of a sudden she realized that she had fantastic prejudices towards faith. You know, because of her rationalism, she was convinced that to have faith meant to be a person of inferior intelligence, a numbskull, someone who is just not intelligent enough to penetrate into being itself. And all of a sudden, she says, there is something that I have overlooked. It did not bring her closer to God. It did not break her to faith, but at least, she said to herself, there is something that I have to investigate into and that I have not properly understood. On the other hand, because the level at Göttingen was so high, Edith suddenly started to lose her footing. She felt somehow the place was on so high a level, and in order to compete, in order to succeed, she decided to work 18 hours a day. She started at 6 in the morning and ended at 12 o'clock at night, having a brief meal brought to her by her landlady that she gulped down in a few moments. And she did this for weeks and months on end, until one very fine day, she was very close to a nervous breakdown. She just had the feeling, I cannot control, I cannot manage all this material. She would never talk to anybody. As I told you, she was so reserved that it was extremely difficult for her to communicate with other people and reveal herself. And one very fine day, one of the two students came to her and said, how are you getting along in your work? And she said, you know, I'm losing my footing. He said, why don't you go to Adolf Reinach, your mentor, and talk to him? And she went to this extraordinary, remarkable man who was killed in the First World War. He was Jewish. And he converted to Christianity shortly before his death. And he received her with extreme kindness. You've got to realize that her state of depression was such that she relates in her autobiography that when she crossed the street, every single time she said to herself, may I be hit by a car and die. When from time to time she went on an excursion, she was always hoping for some mishap so that she would be brought back to Göttingen a corpse. Just to show you how depressed she was because she felt she could not conquer the material that she was handling. Reinach received her with a great deal of loving kindness and encouraged her, and she soon regained her footing and persevered, except that the First World War broke out. Don't forget, in June 1914, the successor to the Austrian throne was assassinated in Sarajevo, a place that today we know full well. And this triggered this terrible war that was going to bleed Europe to death, and to my mind was the first step towards a moral decadence that we witness today. Reinach was Jewish, and he was German, and he was a German patriot, and even, you can say, almost a German nationalist. And even though he was over 30 and very, very nearsighted, he immediately volunteered in the German army, declaring that it was for him an honor to risk his life for his country. Edith Stein went back to Breslau and took a Red Cross course and volunteered to work as a nurse. She wasn't called to duty for a while, and so she went back to Göttingen and continued to work on her dissertation and what we can speak, I mean, getting ready for her doctorate. But then she worked in a Red Cross hospital in Austria for 4 months. And you're not going to be surprised to find out that in no time she was considered to be the best nurse. She knew she had worked, she knew something about medicine by this time, she knew how to treat people, she had a great pedagogical gift, and on top of it, she had this amazing talent for languages. You know, don't forget the Austrian Empire had Czechs and Slovaks and Slovenians and Hungarians, and the Austrian doctors could not communicate. And in no time, Edith managed to pick up some Hungarian and some Czech and, you know, could communicate with his patients. Then she, after 4 months, she abandoned this. She took a vacation. She wasn't called back. And she went back to study for her doctorate. She taught for a while. And then she got the dreadful news of the death of Adolf Reinach, who was killed in Belgium in November 1917. He was buried in Göttingen a few weeks later, and that is when my husband made the acquaintance of Edith Stein. Now, both of them had this loving admiration for Reinach, but because of Edith's extraordinary reserve, no contact was established between them. She remained totally in the background. She was monosyllabic when you spoke to her, and so it is a great source of sorrow that any sort of personal contact between my husband and herself never developed. There was another brilliant student at the University of Göttingen called Hedwig Conrad Martius. And she had also gotten her doctorate summa cum laude under Husserl, something that Edith achieved in 1916. And Edith was staying at her place for a while. Hedwig Conrad Martius and her husband were gone for a few days, and Edith went to the library and found a life of Saint Teresa of Avila. Don't forget, she had no faith, but keep in mind that thanks to Scheler, she had realized that she had prejudices that she had to eliminate. She opened the book. She started reading it in the evening, read the whole night long, and the next morning at 7 o'clock, she said, "I'm going to become a Roman Catholic." She was convinced. She went to buy a Catholic catechism and a Catholic missal, and started to study the missal and the catechism. And at the end of December 1921, she had just turned 30 years of age, she went to the parish priest and she said, "I want to be baptized." And he said, "You know, things are not that easy. First of all, you've got to have some sort of instructions in the faith." And she said, "Father, question me." Her knowledge of Catholicism was so remarkable that he immediately baptized her. She was baptized on the 1st of January, 1922. Now, I'm going to say and to repeat, you cannot conceive of someone more reserved than Edith Stein. You and I might hope to hear a great deal about this extraordinary night that she spent reading St. Teresa of Avila. It is absolutely clear that something amazing took place in her and is going to change her life radically and fundamentally. When people questioned her about her conversion, she would answer in Latin, "Secretum meum mihi," "My secret belongs to me," and she wouldn't say a thing. Edith Stein would have very little understanding for the irreverent curiosity which is so widespread in our society, of course due to television, that we feel we have a right to know, to penetrate into people's personal life, to know details about their marriage or their love or whatever it might be, not to speak of people's religious life, when people sometimes can raise questions that are extraordinarily indiscreet. Edith Stein would have just said, secretum meum mihi. It's my secret. But I'm going to do something that might surprise you. I'm going to try to meditate on what could have taken place, is likely to have taken place in Edith Stein's soul on this amazing night that was brighter than day. There's no doubt that she made discoveries, such amazing discoveries, that it was going to change her life completely and radically, and ultimately lead her to a sort of martyrdom. She always loved truth. She was convinced that the human mind was capable of capturing truth. And by reading St. Teresa of Avila, she discovers that in Christianity, truth is a person. I am the truth. Christ didn't say, I have the truth. He said, I am the truth. Now, this is, of course, a revolutionary discovery. Just imagine the difference of knowing that something is true, or facing a person who is truth itself, a God, because God alone can be truth itself. Now, you can revere, you can esteem, you can revere a statement that is true. My husband says, lying is so evil because it is a lack of reverence for truth. This is the evil of lying. But the very moment that you face truth with a person, you are called upon to adore. I cannot adore a true proposition, but I can adore God. And Edith Stein, for the first time in her life, learns to go on her knees, which she had never done before. She discovers the supernatural. As I told you, she had a very strong moral sense. But all of a sudden, she discovers a dimension, a beauty, a greatness, a sublimity, a song that can only come from above. How often did my husband say to me, I know that Christ is God because his perfection is such that it could not have been invented by a human being. This is something that must come from above. No human man would have been capable of inventing Christ. We can invent heroes, we can invent geniuses, we cannot invent Christ. And basically, who is Christ? God himself, infinite love, coming down, saving humanity through his suffering on the cross. She suddenly discovered that natural virtues are very imperfect virtues. As St. Augustine says, they are splendid vices. Why? Because without humility, no virtue deserves to be called a virtue. Don't forget that we are not virtuous by ourselves. Every single time we do something which is virtuous, it is God's grace and God's gift. Now, obviously, if I believe that it's my own doing, and I'm tainted by pride, and this pride ruins the virtue that I have. This is why it is said in the Gospel that the publican, who is a sinner, is better than the Pharisee, who is a worse sinner, because he's proud. And Edith discovers that it is humility which is the door to true charity. The very moment that I am humble, my heart is open to the beauty and the greatness of other people. She discovers true wisdom. She had longed for it. But there is a supernatural wisdom that can come from God alone, and that one does not learn in libraries, that one does not learn by being bookish, that one doesn't learn by spending 18 hours a day studying. This type of wisdom is learned on one's knees. This is why Chesterton wrote so beautifully, human beings forget how tall they are on their knees. That is a moment when we are truly great, when we recognize that we are nothing and owe everything to God. An overwhelming discovery for Edith was that the savior of the world was a Jew. She was very attached to her people, and she kept this attachment down to the last day of her life. As a matter of fact, we have reason to suspect that she offered her life for Jewish people because her attachment was so deep. Christ was a Jew, and therefore when the Jewish people claim to be the chosen people, that's not an invention, that is a fact. God chose them. Obviously, if the Jewish people had decided that they were the chosen people, this would have very little value, but God has chosen them for some mysterious reason. And she belongs to this blessed race that has given birth to the Savior of the world. In other words, she discovers the privilege that it is to be Jewish, because Christ was a Jew, the Holy Virgin was a Jew, the apostles were Jews, and all of a sudden she sees the beauty of Judaism against the background of Revelation, of Christianity. And at this very moment, she must have felt the deepest sorrow, because so many of her people, I purposely say so many, because it's not true of all of them, rejected Christ and did not recognize the Messiah in the man described by Isaiah, a man of sorrow, a man burdened with suffering, rejected, flouted, trampled upon. And this is the Savior of the world. Now, in this very moment, you can say, Edith discovers her femininity. She discovers the femininity of a Saint Teresa of Avila. And the Saint Teresa of Avila's femininity is to be traced back to her love to the Holy Virgin, the pure flower of Jesse, the descendant of, you know, the noble race of the prophets and David. This extraordinary being, the most perfect of all creatures. And she is Jewish. And she alone was honored to carry the Savior of the world in her womb. And therefore, Edith makes a discovery of what true maternity is. This is going to have a revolutionary effect on her. From this moment on, Edith, the brilliant woman, the one who achieved summa cum laude in Freiburg in Breisgau, the one who is recognized to be the most talented person among her fellow students, and so on and so on, all of a sudden she discovers that her theme of her life is no longer to study and to become a scholar, but to be transformed in Christ. That is now the meaning of her life. But she must tell her mother about her conversion. And she knows that this is going to be a heart-rending affair. She courageously goes to Breslau and embraces her mother and says to her mother, "I have been baptized." She expected scenes. She expected screaming and shouting. Her mother sobbed. Therefore, the most terrible thing that can happen to a child when she causes her mother's tears. And she loves her mother, and her mother loves her. But from this moment on, there's going to be a chasm between Edith and Augusta Stein. And this is going to be the heavy, heavy cross that she will have to carry to the end of her life. And she carries it courageously because she knows that it is by the cross that we are saved. But it is extraordinarily hard. Edith now accepts a very modest job in a high school in Speyer in Germany. Now just imagine, she has a doctor of philosophy, she has the highest awards, she knows many languages, she is a great Latinist and Greek and Spanish and French and German and English, and you just go on. And she teaches in a modest Dominican high school. And German high school means a lot of work. Because believe it or not, in Europe, that at that time at least, today has probably changed, students work. Imagine, they work, they study, they learn. And by the time you're 18, you probably know whatever you will ever know in your life. So it means an enormous amount of work. But she spends hours in front of the tabernacle, because this is where she's going to learn the signs of the cross. And it is in front of the tabernacle that she discovers the true meaning of femininity. She's given an admirable talk in Salzburg in 1930 on the essence of femininity. I'm going to speak about it briefly because in and by itself it's something so valuable that if you can get hold of it, I would urge you to read it. What does she discover? She discovers that a woman is made to be the helpmeet of man, and how much men need to have someone who is going to surround them with love and patience and understanding. In other words, every woman is called upon to be maternal. The trait of women par excellence is maternity. And to be, what is maternity? To accept, to suffer, that another person may live. And today, you understand the abomination of abortion, which is the greatest betrayal of the holy mission given to women. Edith understands that women have a much deeper relationship with persons than with objects. You know, between us, don't say that to men. This is one of the crushing superiorities that women have over men. They care a great deal more for persons than for things. You know, the passion of men for abstractions. You know, and Chesterton says very wittily that if a husband or a man doesn't have a wise wife who pulls him down on earth, well, he's just going to go mad, because he goes from abstraction to abstraction to abstraction and finally loses a sense of concrete reality. Of course, women have a much deeper sense for what is living than what is non-living. You know, you just made the following experiments. I haven't done it, but it'd be interesting to make you. You have men and women, and they come into a room. And on one side of the room, there's a baby in a cradle, a young baby. And on the other side, there's a computer. And the women, why do you laugh? You know what's going to happen. The women will rush to the baby because they're intelligent. A baby is infinitely more fascinating, deep, challenging, that, you know, mysterious than a computer. Men will have a look at the baby and then immediately say, well, I hope I don't have to change the diapers, and then run to the computers. Well, Edith knows that. She knows that women are much moved by images and contents than by concepts. Not that they can't do it. Edith was very good at handling concepts. But somehow it dries you out. There is a dimension of humanity, of personality, that dries out if you remain in this world. And I mean, this is why I've met some men in my life. I mean, they're just machines producing thoughts and concepts. But the very moment, they don't seem to see you. They're just constantly concerned about this. I mean, this is the deformation. What is the greatness of women? To listen, to be receptive, to embrace, to shelter, to console, to help. And Edith remarks how desperately men need this. Of course, they'll rather die than acknowledge that they need a loving woman. But in fact, we all know that it is easy for a woman to crush a man's personality if she doesn't give him the comfort and the love that he desperately needs, even though he will not acknowledge it. It is a greatness of women to want to share things. You know, I know women who turn to botany because their husband loved botany, who turn to football because he's a football fan, and this is heroic to my mind. But I mean, some of them do it. Or they would turn even to mathematics because he's a mathematician, or to music. You know, I know a cousin of mine who was definitely not very musical, but her husband had a passion for music, and she went from one concert to another to share. You know, this is so beautifully feminine. But of course, as Edith Stein remarks, the very moment that these lovely traits that God has put in man's, in women's nature, are not transformed in Christ. They change into the opposite. And a woman can become self-centered. She can become very vanitous, terribly concerned to be praised and to be honored. She can become whiny every single time she has the slightest little pain and she starts complaining. She can become narrow instead of having the wideness of someone open to other people's interest. And so Edith realizes that unless women truly discover the Holy Virgin who was the most perfect creature ever created and who is a perfect model of femininity, all these lovely traits are going to be weakened, are going to be lost. And therefore, a woman can turn to become terribly preoccupied about herself, become gossipy instead of being receptive. You know, this is why they have a reputation of being big gossips. Well, in fact, when a woman truly understands her mission, she's not gossipy, she's listening. And she can listen, which means to open herself to another person completely and totally. One of the great dangers of women, you know, when they accept donation to another person, is that they can become extraordinarily possessive. You see, instead of self-giving, they produce a child, they bring a child to the world, and then they want to possess it. And I know women, you know, very devoted, but when the child is 25 and 30 and 35 and 40, they still try to dominate and to possess it because of the mother. This is a caricature of femininity. Women then have the danger of being so involved in a cause that they become terribly, terribly narrow and are only concerned about their personal interests or their personal likings or their personal family. And I mean, this is why sometimes it is a lot better when men exercise the functions of juror and judges than when women do it, for the very plain reason that they have a danger to become partisans, then to become narrow. You know, it is someone of your race, it is someone of your color, it is someone of your background, it is someone that you happen to like, and then you misjudge a situation because of this narrowness that takes over. Therefore, she must be transformed. And she must be transformed by Christ. And precisely because she's a woman, and this is something that Edith knew from St. Teresa of Avila, women are particularly receptive to Christ's message. Teresa of Avila says in the autobiography that she knew many more women than men who have received extraordinary graces. And St. Peter of Alcantara agrees with her. And what is the reason? They are more receptive. A woman accepts more readily to be helped. And this is once again one of the blessings of maternity. Because when you expect a child and you know that you have to give birth, you fear and you tremble because your hour has come. You know that you're going to face suffering and you pray. It is easier for a woman to remember that she's a creature and she's not the creator. The danger with men is that when they're extraordinarily intelligent or successful, all of a sudden they believe they can do it on their own. And so Edith is absolutely convinced that it is by developing her femininity, by truly becoming what she's called upon to be, that she can fulfill her mission in the world and in among her people. As I told you, she taught for 8 years in this mediocre, let us say, modest, very modest position in Speyer. In 1932, she was offered a much better job. It was not a university job, but nevertheless, it was a much better job, linked to the University of Münster in northern Germany. She went there and once again was extraordinarily successful. By now, she had quite a reputation as a lecturer. She had lectured in Czechoslovakia, in Vienna, in France, in all over Germany. She was highly thought of, and she teaches there. And after 6 months, Adolf Hitler seized power in Germany. And on the 30th of January 1933, Germany fell into the hands of this criminal, was going to remain in his grips for 12 years. Useless to say, Edith lost her job because her blood was impure. And in this very moment, she went to her spiritual director, and she had been going to him for years and expressed the ardent desire to enter the Carmel. After all, she owed her conversion to Saint Teresa of Avila and always felt an enormous attraction for the Carmel. He says, "Now look, I have no more chance of exercising any sort of mission in this world as you wanted me to do," and he gave his permission. And at the age of 42, she decided to enter the Carmel. But obviously, she had to tell her family. And then, from this moment on, Edith had to carry a crushing cross. She went to Breslau, and with all her love and sweetness and tenderness, she said to her mother that she was going to enter the Carmel. And when the mother understood it, she was beside herself. There were scenes followed by access of tears for hours on that lasted for whole months. And Edith said, "I do not know whether it was harder on her or on me, that in some way both of us could have died from this sorrow." And nevertheless, Edith Stein chose to abandon Breslau and to enter the Carmel and to offer her life, and I'm convinced that she did so quite consciously, for her people. She entered on the 15th of October, 1933, the feast of Saint Teresa of Avila. Up to now, she had been the intellectual, and one of the first questions that was raised, "Can you sew?" No, she had never sewn anything in her life. I sympathize fully. But she had to do humble, mediocre work, and she, even though she wasn't good at it, for the first time in her life, she was a total failure, but she persevered until after 3 or 4 years, she was given permission to go back to intellectual work. And then she worked on her last book, The Science of the Cross, which, as you can well realize, was not learned in libraries, was learned in sacrifice and prayer. But of course, the situation in Germany and the persecution of the Jews became more and more violent. And in 1938, she was transferred to the Carmelite convent in Holland. Her mother had died in 1936. Edith constantly wrote to her, but as far as her mother was concerned, Edith was dead. Thank God, Augusta Stein was never sent to a concentration camp, but 4 of her 7 children died in concentration camps. Thank God she never experienced it. Edith moved to Holland. In the meantime, one of her sisters, Rose, had converted to Catholicism, never dared to do so as long as her mother lived, and joined her sister, even though she did not become a nun, but she was working in the convent for the nuns. And the situation became more and more dramatic when, on the 10th of May, 1940, the Germans invaded Holland and Belgium, and then France, that they conquered. And so the situation became extremely dangerous for her. And her superior wrote to a Swiss Carmelite convent in Le Paquet, outside of Fribourg, to try to convince them to invite Edith to come over. But you know what bureaucracy is. And Swiss bureaucracy was not very good at it, and it was postponed and postponed and postponed and always finding new excuses. And in 1942, the Dutch bishops wrote a letter that was read in all the Catholic churches in Holland, condemning anti-Semitism and condemning the persecution of the Jews. The next day, the Gestapo retaliated by saying that all the Jews that had converted to Christianity were to be sent to concentration camp. Edith was and her sister were drawn out, pulled out of the convent. They were given 10 minutes to leave and then brought to a camp, from there to Auschwitz. And according to what we know, we had never had final details. She was gassed on the 9th of August, 1942. Now, when you look at her life, which is in some way a tragic life and a glorious life, because glory and tragedy belong to Christian life, you just say to yourself, it is so tragic that her family never recognized that she was truth-loving, and that she found truth, she had to follow it. It is quite understandable for her siblings, but what is less understandable is that Augusta Stein, who was so deeply rooted in Judaism, was so profoundly pious, who knew the Bible, did not recall the story of Abraham and Isaac. Isaac, the son of the promise. Isaac, the beloved of Abraham. And God says to him, take your son and sacrifice him to me. Can you imagine the heartbreak for a father whose son was a son of the promise, that he waited for Isaac for long? Abraham does not hesitate. He will obey God's order. And for 3 days, he walks to this mount with the child next to him, and the child says, Father, I see the wood, but I don't see the victim. And Abraham says, God will provide. You know, the story ended well. But in fact, you can see he did sacrifice Isaac because he accepted to. Can't we say the tragedy and the glory of Edith Stein is the story of Abraham in reverse? She was called upon, quote, to sacrifice her mother in order to follow Christ. And this is what she accepted to do with a bleeding, broken heart. Subjectively, she felt she was sacrificing this beloved mother, this noble woman, for the sake of following Christ. But can't we hope, because of God's infinite mercy, that at the moment of death, the noble Augusta Stein received the grace of recognizing that Christ is the King of the Jews. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. We now have time for questions. That was a very moving talk. I'm sure it touched all of us and touched our hearts and our minds and souls and inspired us. But first, I'd like to make one little comment or one question I have for Dr. von Hildebrand, and that's if Edith Stein was in contact with or she knew of Archbishop von Galen in Münster in Germany. Archbishop von Galen was very, very outspoken against some of the crimes that took place in Germany with the rise of the Nazis. And it gave 3 tremendous and well-known homilies around that theme. He never personally mentioned the problem with the attack on the Jews, and some say that it was precisely because of the situation that Dr. von Hildebrand has mentioned when the church in Holland spoke out so strongly about it, there was a persecution immediately. And from what they surmise is that Bishop von Galen was advised not to speak out because it would only backfire. Do you know if she had any contact at all with Bishop von Galen?
Not that I know of, but I mean, don't forget, Edith Stein left Germany in 1938. I don't know exactly when Bishop von Galen delivered these very beautiful speeches. I can only tell you, through my husband's memoirs, that unfortunately, in 1933, most German bishops were not terribly clear about the horror of Nazism. And it's only when the Nazis started showing their real faces that some of them courageously woke up, and no doubt von Galen was the most admirable among them. But unfortunately, we have to face the fact, which is historically proven, that in 1933 many bishops were in no way clear about the nature of Nazism. As far as I know, no, I don't know when, I've never heard anything, any connection between von Galen and Edith Stein. I mean, don't forget, once you're in a Carmelite order, you're totally shut off from the world. There's something that I forgot to say, which I believe is extremely important, that Edith was, as I tell you, very severe looking, very stern face. When she took her final vows, and friends of her, you know, from the academic world, came to Cologne, all of them were struck by the fact that she was totally rejuvenated. If you see photographs of Edith when she was a student in Göttingen, and photographs of Edith in the convent, it is amazing the change that has taken place in her. Her face had acquired a sweetness, a lovableness, a radiance, which was in no way visible before. I mean, in other words, her femininity had truly blossomed thanks to grace.
Here's the first question is, do you think that Thomistic thought is compatible with the phenomenological thought?
Truth is always compatible with truth. Whatever is true in Thomism will, of course, have no conflict with true phenomenology. You know, in other words, let me quote St. Augustine, who says, whatever is true is ours. The difference between the two is a difference of methods. But obviously in Thomism you find very many truths, and then there are certain intellectual weaknesses. And in phenomenology you find good many truths, and then obviously not the very best also make their mistakes. I mean, but you see, the main thing, it seems to me, that we should not be so much concerned about the school of thought. We should be concerned about the question of truth, whether it is St. Bonaventure or St. Anselm or St. Augustine or St. Thomas or the good phenomenologists. I say the good ones because, unfortunately, later in his life, Husserl took a totally different direction. And then all his younger students turned away from him because he became an idealist once again. And then I believe that his work has been extremely destructive and dangerous. And I mean, this is what Edith, who did some work, she did a translation of St. Thomas, and this is what she was trying to show. Whatever is true is ours, period, because Christ is the truth.
Do you think that Pope John Paul II, for whom I have great love and respect, integrates these two philosophical systems?
Well, I mean, I do believe that he was marked by both, and this is very visible in his remarkable encyclicas.
Has anyone come forward and written of Edith's last days and words? Have there been any books written about her last days and her last words?
Well, I mean, you'll find this in various biographies. I read one recently of a French nun. There might be others, and they're certainly worth getting to know because we don't know the details, but one thing is certain. She was heroic to the very end. When she was in the first concentration camp in Holland, she was taking care of babies when the mother were totally beside themselves and losing totally their footing. And then, she just sacrificed herself.
Do you see any connection for industrialized modern Catholic women between recovering traditional women's work such as cooking, sewing, gardening, changing diapers, and the recovery of femininity?
Well, changing diapers has to be done in any case.
Well said.
And when it comes to, you know, these feminine tasks, you know, the whole question is what my husband used to call the theme of Christ. Obviously, women are placed in very different circumstances. If you are married and you have children, well, you have to attend, you have to cook. You have to do practical things because you have to take care of your family. But if you are not married, or if you are a widow, or you happen, I mean, you might be called upon to do other things. The main thing is for women to meditate daily on the words of the Holy Virgin, I am the handmaid of the Lord. What does he want me to do? And then if you are receptive and you listen and listen, and listen, instead of talking and being gossipy, you'll find out what he wants.
What is the true meaning of the biblical submissiveness in holy marriage, being submissive to one's wives, to husbands?
You know, the best answer that I can give you, if it is any good, is that subjective doesn't mean inferior. Christ, when he came back from Bethlehem, after having been lost in the temple for 3 days, came back to Nazareth. And it is written in the Gospel of St. Luke, he was subject to them. Now, just imagine the situation. St. Joseph was a creature marked by original sin. Mary was a creature with no original sin. And Christ was God. And who was the boss? St. Joseph. Would you like to be in his shoes? You know, this is precisely what I'm going to say in my next talk and speak about authority. To be in a position of authority doesn't mean that you are superior, but it simply means that you have been given a responsibility that you have to carry out. And so therefore I simply say to say that a woman is subject to her husband, if it is properly understood, it is a tremendous blessing because, as I'll say tomorrow, to have authority is a very risky and difficult business. It's much safer to obey than to command.
I'd like to thank you again for that wonderful and very moving and inspiring talk. Thank you very much.